I'm joined here with Rabbit and Alex von Goldstein. We're going to be discussing radical centrism, cultural elitism, and Gore Vidal. Great having you guys on the show.
Hey.
Always a pleasure to be on with you guys.
Rabbit, you have this thing going on, this project called The Alt Left, and your website is altleft.com. And this whole thing kind of got its start with Robert Lindsay, but it's very, the alt-left pretty much, I would say, is pretty much similar to the concept of radical centrism. Rabbit, if you just want to kind of give a very brief introduction to the alt-left, I know we've discussed it before to our audience, and how it kind of relates to the alt-right and to like the radical center. I do remember you made a point that the alt-left kind of exists in the space between like a Ralph Nader and a Pat Buchanan, and I remember a while back Bay Area guy wrote that in his article about the radical center.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it basically, you know, like you, when I was a lot younger, I was would have considered myself like more right-wing or kind of a Republican. But I found that, you know, the opposite of like most people's experience, like I became more left wing as I got older, especially like as I worked more in the corporate world and things like that. And so I think that what I discovered, though, is that, like over time there really is no room in the left now for white people. So there's just everything. I remember, like, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, I started even looking at like the Communist Party's website and these other sites, and it was almost 100% just devoted to everything anti-white. It was very little to the, you know, the old Soviet stuff or what you would have seen before that. And so I guess the alternative left is just, you know, for people who are left-wing on most issues politically, but aren't like a self-hating white person, or you know, don't buy into a lot of the political correctness that's now almost a, you know, totally that's now almost the entirety of the left's focus.
And they basically abandon all other issues or all their traditional concerns like the environment, workers' rights. Basically, the mainstream left is all about diversity and globalism. And example of that is with the Brexit. The entire left and the media, except for like a few sort of fringe dissident leftists, pretty much were against the Brexit, even though the EU is responsible for, there was this article that showed you, I posted a while back that said all these billionaires could lose their money because of the Brexit, because globalization contributes so much to income inequality and consolidation of wealth.
But you know what's funny, I've talked to some of these people about billionaires and stuff like that, how they benefit from globalism. And, you know, I think the idea that persists through most leftist thinking is that if the mindset of the person is good, regardless if they're a billionaire and how they're making their money, if they think good things, then they're a good person. So, like, if you say, oh, well, George Soros really funded this organization, they say, well, it doesn't really matter because the organization is good. And that's kind of the way that they think. It's all about their ideology. It's really about nothing else. It's not about action at all.
Right, and that's with Brexit. It's another thing where you find that they're increasingly on the same side as these global corporations, and they've completely abandoned the idea of self-determination, even for you know, not just for countries like European countries and America, but also self-determination for a lot of these smaller third world nations. Now they still want to intervene, but on you know, for different reasons. They still want to be involved, and they've abandoned a lot of their you know, trade policies and protectionism and whatnot, because they think that it's actually almost good to exploit these workers in the third world. They let these companies in there because it's going to build them up and then take away, you know, money from white people in the United States. You know, so it's like they've completely abandoned a lot of it. It's just, if you're, there's just no reason if you're a white person who isn't ethno-masochistic to, you know, to get involved with the left in its current manifestations.
Well, you do have people like Noam Chomsky, and he made this documentary recently speaking out against globalization and like international bankers. Noam Chomsky, even though he's well respected by a lot of leftists, he's like also against Hillary Clinton. Basically, the entire ideology within most of the left within the Democratic Party, excluding some of the Sanders supporters, but the pretty much dominant ideology is in favor of basically neoliberalism.
Yeah, I'd say so. But, you know, also even the people who claim to be opposed are hypocrites in a way, because they're not really taking their own views to the conclusion, to the result. So it'd be like kind of like how they support a $15 minimum wage, you know, which is great, but then they want to let millions of people into the United States. Well, you can't have a $15 minimum wage and import millions of people. Like, it's just going to be a disaster, because they're not going to be jobs for all those people. Same thing with health care. You can't have free health care and import millions of people from the third world. You know, it has to be a very delicately balanced system. I think that's something that someone like Gore Vidal understood, but some of these other ones are complete. They're not following their logic to the conclusion. They're not being consistent.
I think this is a tremendous opportunity for any kind of a dissident movement, whether you want to call it the alt-left or the radical center, to take up all these issues that have been abandoned by the left. Instead of trying to be, I think a lot of people try to be like really conservative, ultra conservative or reactionary, but that's doomed to fail. But the key is picking up on these issues that the left has abandoned, like civil liberties, the environment, anti-war, workers' rights. So I think there's a lot of opportunities for a kind of an alt-left or radical center if you can successfully market it. But the problem is people are kind of caught up into this a one-sided thinking that you're either like a liberal or a conservative. You even see this issue within the alt-right as well. Like, I was listening to a Matt Forney podcast, and Matt Forney was saying, like, you're either with the left or you're with the right, and the left is the enemy. So you see that mentality in the alt-right as well.
Yeah, I see a lot of that, and the alt-right is a really big tent group, and at least when I was more active in it, I noticed that there are certain factions within the alt-right that they're just not they're not reconcilable. Their positions are, you know, if you're like a radical traditionalist Christian, like, you're not going to get, you know, you're not going to come to terms with some of these other factions that aren't, you know, because if you're a Christian or any religion, really, like, if you're really a true believer, then, you know, the other people, like, they have to be converted. Like, you know what I mean? You can't have these different factions that are have polar opposite goals, and then the big tent is just, it's not going to function properly. It's because it's not it hasn't even been set what the core beliefs are.
Well, basically, the alt-right is a big tent movement for people who oppose political correctness and mass immigration and globalization. You have a lot of people like ourselves, as well as a Bay Area guy, Anatoly Karlin, and I know Anne Sturzinger, she also described herself as like a radical moderate or radical centrist. Even I was speaking to Richard Spencer on a podcast a while back, I'll link to it, and he basically, Richard Spencer really likes the idea of radical centrism, even comes across that way himself, and I know when he relinked to the show, he did a blog post, Extreme Moderation. But at the same time, I mean, Richard Spencer, I think he's actually closer to us, but because his audience is a lot more very right-wing, so he does have to cater to his audience to a degree, but I think there's a lot of people out there who do think like us.
I completely agree, and I think that, you know, like Spencer and, you know, Hannibal Bateman and others, I think that they're fairly close to some of my views politically and maybe yours, but it's the fact that it's part of the right wing and the audience that they're catering to in order to that they're appealing to, it ends up bringing in a lot of this, I guess, southerner, just kind of like right wing Republican kind of residue is comes in with it based on the kind of people that you're trying to appeal to. So yeah, I think that a lot of them are actually fairly close to our views,
I know Richard studied like, you know, he sort of comes from a background of like post-Marxism and, you know, super opposed to capitalism. And, you know, he's linked to Slavoj Žižek on his Twitter many times. So there's a weird way, there's this weird line of thinking that I have sometimes that people like us are the logical extension of left-wing thinking. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's like if you're viewing like left-wing thinking linearly, that's, you know, opposed to stuff like the IMF, WTO, and then, you know, you see this political correctness thing, which basically, you know, is globalism masking itself as a real left, that we sort of see past that.
I know what you're talking about. It's been described as like the horseshoe theory. And the horseshoe theory was actually, I think the political scientist who came up with that idea, I think he was pretty much more kind of establishment, and he was implying it was a bad thing. But the theory is you have a horseshoe, and the establishment's at the top, and the further right you go and the further left you go, the closer together you get. And
yeah,
I guess
think where we,
radical center
yeah.
would be radical center would be the exact middle between the dissident left and the dissident right.
It's the part of the horseshoe that's floating in nothing, you know.
Yeah.
That's what I was. I explained that to some people last year, actually, before all this stuff went totally haywire. People who were like, you know, fairly left wing. I said to them that, yeah, like you have this horseshoe theory, and they roll their eyes because that's what libertarians use to say that they're the best. You know, they're like, well, the far right and the far left on the horseshoe are the same thing. Libertarians, we're on the other side of it, so we're the best. But we're actually, you know, the thing that's like diametrically opposed to these establishment libertarian types.
I think a lot of libertarians would probably call us like liberal fascist.
Yeah, yeah, like Jonah Goldberg. But I think like, yeah, we exist in the part of the horseshoe that's floating in nothingness because what we talk about is metapolitical.
Yeah,
for the most part.
I actually identify a lot more with some of the more like old school white nationalist types from the like the 70s and 80s. A lot of those, they were much more left wing. If you watch any of the old videos of Tom Metzger and, you know, people like Wyatt Kallenberg, who was a member of the Young Socialist Alliance before that, and he used to write a paper called The Democratic Socialist. And if you watch a lot of the old Metzger videos, it's clear that his views are very leftist on a variety of economic and also cultural subjects, whereas like now you see a lot of the white nationalist community is kind of arisen out of this post-Republican,
post-libertarian.
So also the post-right-wing, the Southern Christian.
There's also a group of people, I'm not sure if you're familiar with them, but there's groups like the New Resistance, and they're kind of nationalist. They're economically leftist, but they're socially conservative. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's not my views. My views are closer to like the more of the West Coast nationalist style, which actually makes sense when you talk about people like Metzger and those, because those all arose out of Southern California, so they were more laid back culturally on cultural issues, but they were dealing with the problems of multiculturalism at the time. I think that they were really just ahead of their time as far as these issues, because they were dealing with them when the rest of the country wasn't. A lot of people seem to think that these, these old school like groups like White Aryan Resistance and whatnot, that they were just kind of like idiots and uncouth. A lot of them were at that time. I like to see it as nationalism was a solution to a problem that didn't exist for most people. Because the U.S. was 90% white, so they weren't really – other people just didn't see a need for this kind of stuff. But people who were in Southern California or whatever, they were exposed to these kinds of issues at that time. And now, like when the U.S. is 60% white or something like that, 65%, you're starting to see that these issues resurface that they dealt with 30 years ago.
And I also think about the question is what is your target demographics of an alt-left or a radical center? Is it sort of the traditional sort of populist demographics, people who would have maybe supported candidates like Buchanan in the past? Or is it people who are maybe like Swipples or the children of sort of upper middle class liberals who are starting to become sort of red-pilled in the sense that they're seeing a society decay? So I think we need to sort of look to different audiences instead of the stereotype of people who would support sort of populist movements traditionally. I've talked about that in the past. As things get worse, people who would have been, say, upper middle class in the past get pushed further down. But in a sense, that attracts more people who are more culturally sophisticated and intellectual. Kind of like the stereotype that the establishment puts out is that all like this populist dissidents are they're all a bunch of like toothless like rednecks.
Right. I think that the the Buchanan kind of populists or whatever, I think they pretty much, those are the old paleo conservatives, and they pretty much fall get absorbed pretty neatly into the alt-right, I think, where it exists. I think you do see that's where a lot of the conflict is, though, is from like the Buchanan, traditionally Buchanan was always big anti-abortion and whatnot, and then, like the
super Catholic
people, and radics or whatever that are more like accepting of, homosexuality and abortion and things like that. So I think that that's where you see a lot of the friction there. But the Buchanan people, for the most part, seem to have been absorbed by the alt-right. I think our target should be a lot of the Ralph Nader people and a lot of the people that live in Portland and Boulder, Colorado, and these other kind of places that are essentially living in a in a white identity civilization. They're just totally they're totally unaware of it.
Places like Boulder, Colorado, they're basically the ideal places to live. I would say that the worst places to live would be the combination of conservatism and diversity. Like, I think Texas is like the worst example of a place that has, like, Texas is both has conservative politics, but it's also diverse, and Texas has one of the lowest standards of living. So yeah, these white, sort of white dominated, white liberal communities have the best qualities of life. But the problem is they're very expensive places to live. And in an ideal society, I think you would, even in a lot of places in Europe, even today with the whole migrant situation, if you have large numbers of places that are nice places to live, then they're affordable for the middle class. But the problem with America is that most places are either, you have places that are basically ghetto, or you have places that are just really ugly and overrun with tract housing. So the few places that are decent are vastly overpriced. So if you made that kind of quality of life accessible to more people than it would be, then I think that would be a strong point.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, what's happening is that the, the government is aware of these kinds of things. So they're putting in process a plan to basically dump minorities into these communities. That's why they don't, when they get refugees or whatnot, they're dumping them all over the place, and they're trying to put in plan, housing plans and incentives to get minorities to move into these whitetopias.
They do that with middle class places. Like I know Minneapolis has a lot of Somalis, but they don't do that with the ultra wealthy places like Boulder.
Well, I think it's coming though. I think it will come eventually because those places, the people that they're governed by, they're not racially aware, so they're just going to be like, oh. We'll take your refugees. Like, we love, refugees welcome in Boulder, Colorado. You know, they dump 10,000 of them in there. And then, I can see that becoming more of a thing. It's more like it's something that they haven't figured out to do yet. But they're going to get there.
As far as politics go, we mostly talk about metapolitics. But I also think elections are very important. And if you analyze candidates, I think traditionally it's been sort of a lot of these kind of old school Democrats, like the Blue Dog Democrats from the Midwest and even the South, kind of are pretty close to radical centrism. But we sort of have to look at the future. Basically, the Democrats are becoming the party of diversity. And I'd ideally like to see a strong third party, and in the past we had the Reform Party, which was kind of a radical centrist party, but the system is so rigged against third parties that basically leaves us with the Republican Party, and I don't like the Republican Party at all, but it could be that we have no other alternatives. If you look at Donald Trump, I think he could be kind of a radical centrist because I've read his book from a while back when he was running for office as a Reform Party candidate, but he still has to kind of appeal to the Republican Party, so that kind of corrupts things. Alex and I interviewed a Senate candidate, Ron Unz, and he's probably the closest to a radical centrist candidate that I can think of anyone running for office, but he ended up only getting about maybe 1%, maybe 2%.
Yeah, I think that it's tough to really tell what Trump's actual views are, because he's also a businessman, so he's navigating the marketplace of viewpoints to get elected. I do think that the only thing that matters to me as far as Trump really, I guess, is his willingness to say things and not apologize. It's giving a life to people who had basically had really abandoned the idea that a political figure would actually say something that would reveal an unpleasant truth about any subject. That's something I hasn't until Trump. That was something that was almost unheard of.
Just putting these issues out there, just making people comfortable expressing them, expanding the Overton window, bringing attention to issues like trade and mass immigration. Those are very crucial issues. I think he's pushing things in the right direction. He's not ideal, but I think it's a huge first step.
But the problem with Donald Trump, though, is his language. And, people like us can kind of look past that. because we're just concerned with the issues. But we have to be honest and understand that most people don't think at all. And they let Huffington Post think for them, and they let Salon think for them. And, you know, I think that that's the biggest problem for any dissident movement, is that the media is going to be completely opposed to it. And, you know, it's like, okay, yeah, we want to reach people, we want to have this alternative media, but, you know, it's, if you're not really part of it, if you're not really tuned in to the idea of the establishment being against you, it's going to be pretty hard to, like, you know, for a normal person to, like, look at something like even our conversations without wincing.
Yeah, I think that one advantage Trump has, though, is that he has such like a huge built-in following already that they can't ignore him. So even when he does is, even when they attack him and they try to tie him to all these groups or whatever, they end up drawing people into our sphere because they're pointing them towards all of these other websites and figures in all of these articles or something that they would have had no ability to market themselves otherwise. And so you see all of these people, you know, mainstream news publications writing about Richard Spencer and Countercurrents and things like that as a means to attack Trump. But meanwhile, you know, they're sending a whole generation of people to explore these ideas, and they don't realize that a lot of them are going to be persuaded by this stuff once they find their way into
these
spheres.
I mean, there is a certain kind of seductive danger that can come from someone like Richard Spencer. You know, just in the way that he presents himself and the way that he sort of, like, when I listen to Richard Spencer talk, I feel like I'm hearing someone that is kind of like me. You know, there's a guy who grew up on, like, you know, Dune and Stanley Kubrick movies, and just became disillusioned with this system and is an erudite, intelligent person. You know, and I hear someone like him speak, and I'm like, well, I kind of relate to him, and sort of go further down that rabbit hole. Whereas, you know, then once you're exposed to that, then the mainstream media just kind of seems like bullshit. So, yeah, you're pretty right there, I think. But I feel like, you know, the whole problem is outreach, about, you know, expanding beyond the kind of echo chamber of, you know, how we're supposed to act towards each other or something like that, if that makes any sense, if you get what I'm talking about there.
I think the key is having media outlets. I think the alt-right is fantastic, and sites like Aradix and Countercurrents, but they're a little bit more kind of a niche. I think like a site like Unst.com is sort of the closest I can think of to a kind of a radical centrist site, where it's a big tent website that includes a lot of different political dissidents, from paleo conservatives to like some dissident leftists like Alex Cochran.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's definitely a great resource, and I think that people that are open-minded will check that out. But I also feel that, you know, there's this Herbert Marcuse line of thinking in that, you know, all right-wing ideas are to be intolerated and all left-wing ideas are to be tolerated. And I think that there's some people who, like, religiously hold on to these beliefs and, like, police their friends. And it's like these people are, you know, a roadblock for others who would be into what we're into. It's like these sort of, like, real, like, hammer on, like, it's their religion. This kind of, like, social justice stuff is their total religion.
There's this concept of the Nolan chart that libertarians point out, and you basically have, like, a libertarianism versus status, and then conservatives are status on social issues, liberals are status on economic issues. I'm kind of want to go over, like, a radical centrism, like what issues would overlap with libertarianism, what issues would overlap with statism. Maybe it would overlap with libertarianism on like a civil liberty, privacy issues. Maybe it would be more to the left on environmental protection and zoning. Maybe it would be right wing on like national sovereignty issues. So what are some of your thoughts on which issue should be the state should be in charge, and which issues should be like issues of individual liberty?
Yeah, because my answer is going to throw a wrench in the machine. Like, I'm a huge anti-state thinker. You know, I don't believe that, you know, states have only existed for 1% of human history. I don't think that they're going to continue. I think that states right now, they've gotten too big. Their economic systems are all tied in with each other, you know, in total stagnation. And they can't go to war with one another, because if they did, it would be mutually assured destruction. So I think over the next, you know, couple centuries at least, if I'm thinking super long term, we'll see a dissolution, you know, the states dissolving and into more, you know, pan-secessionist type of, well, it's not like a neo-feudalism, but, you know, sort of like a new political paradigm arise. So my whole thing that I preach forward is decentralization of power, because I think a lot of the problems that we talk about right now, they wouldn't happen if there wasn't this massive state apparatus controlling everyone.
Well, I did see an article on Attack, I think it was Attack the System, the other day about Switzerland's Kanzen model.
Yeah, that's what I'm into, yeah.
And the thing about Switzerland is, I think, well, obviously it's a very wealthy country and there's a lot of different factors, but they seem to, out of all countries, have the most sensible policies. You could even say kind of radical centrist, because they're libertarian on the sensible issues. Like, there's stronger privacy, civil liberty protections, there's strong gun rights, but at the same time, they're not like these crazy libertarians who want open borders and that want to destroy the environment. I mean, Switzerland has probably the toughest immigration laws in Europe.
Don't you have to vote? Like, the community votes. There's like a sense of like voluntarism. So if
I
believe this is true. If someone wants to move into, you know, the community, the other members of the community vote to bring that person in. And, you know, I'm like a big localist. I'm a big like communitarian. I think people should be less concerned with their rights and more concerned with their duties, and like live an active life and be concerned with the welfare of their community. So, I mean, that's where my thinking, you know, I sort of come from like an anarchist milieu, and, you know, I advocate pan-secession, and I advocate people sort of, you know, being very active in their communities. I don't think that we have like, I don't think we should be focused on rights. I think we should be focused on duties.
Yeah, I think that that we're going to see like nations still, but they're going to be smaller states. I think that the U.S. is way too big to be able to encompass all of the different groups and areas in the country. So I think it's almost like it's too late to save the U.S. as a whole, because it's too big. I think we'll see more of like a balkanization in some of these areas. I think that the EU, it looks like, isn't going to survive, and we'll see like a revival of nationalism in some of these countries, and then maybe there'll be a few others. I don't think it's going to be...
What you're saying is, like, with the United States, we're all kind of have this mentality that we're all in this together because we're one big country. I basically agree with you. What will happen in Europe is some countries will collapse, but then the countries that survive will go in a more nationalistic direction. But with pan-secessionism, I like the idea, but I don't see how it would benefit me where I am here in California.
Well, you could go somewhere else, Robert.
I don't necessarily want to live in like Idaho.
But what if you could live in Idaho and it would be your ideal, you know, maybe the area wouldn't be your ideal, but you'd be around people.
I think we should try to recolonize California, but that might be too much of a pipe dream.
Well, I think that the problem is that there is, with California, it's too late. You know, like the time to save California would have been in the 80s and 90s when these other groups, they already fought that battle. They lost. You know, back the Pete Wilson and all those people, like, they lost, and it's over. There is a possibility, though, that you could see, like a Northern California secession, you know, with like Silicon Valley and all of that. So that's still a possibility. I think that, you know, the idea of like once these areas get to be like populated with a certain amount of foreigners and whatnot, like they breed so fast that you're not going to like out hump them to take the place over. Like it's just not going to happen. Like you have to go someplace that where there is like not a lot of these people, take over those institutions and then keep everyone else out, because you know you're not going to get people to move to Northern California and live in a studio apartment and have like 10 kids. You know, only like third world people are willing to live under those conditions. Like you're never going to be able to convince like you know, low time preference people with, you know, future time orientation that's a good idea for them to do it. They're just not going to do it.
I'd like to get your both of your guys' thoughts on capitalism. I have a more nuanced view on this. I mean, I'm not a total commie, but I think capitalism does lead to a lot of a great innovation if there is people are competing and they have that ambition that leads to innovation. And also capitalism has financed plenty of there's been plenty of great architecture that has been created by capitalism. So to a degree, capitalism isn't 100% bad. But when capitalism is unfettered and unregulated, it grows out of control and it destroys itself. And that's what we're seeing today. The culture decays, leads to all these different problems. So the key is there needs to be sensible regulations, and that those regulations do involve the government. They include like zoning laws, environmental protection, protectionism, border control, financial regulation of Wall Street, and so on.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm pretty much with you. I'm pretty anti-capitalist. I think that just the whole idea of people being using money as the number one incentive for anything. You see it now that they're willing to sacrifice anything for a buck. You know, whether it be like they'll bring people into their own neighborhood to destroy it if it means they can make a few extra bucks. Like they will do. You know, companies used to dump toxic sewage in rivers and stuff because it was like, you know, it was a means to a profit. Like people will literally do anything for money. So I'd like to get away from this idea that that money is something that's important. You know, that's why one thing I hate about these conservatives in the Republic, like, their whole worldview revolves around like, oh, but this is, you know, this is bad for business and for the economy. And it's like, well, who cares? You know, I think that, capitalism at one point did lead to a lot of innovations and whatnot, but at a certain time these people figured out that, that they could invent things that like weren't even really useful, that if they could just market them as being useful. You see that in the drug industry all the time now, with people coming out with these like medications that are just like just a tiny, they've proven to be just a tiny bit more effective than some other thing with just the time, and then billions of dollars of marketing goes into it and promoting it. You know, they figured it out. So I don't know. Even when you had in the Soviet Union, they had, they were first to put a man in space. They had tons of technological advancements. I think it comes down to a lot of the people. Even now in these European socialist countries, you see a lot of medical breakthroughs and things like that in research. So I can see how capitalism does these things, but I definitely don't. It doesn't appeal to me that much, I'll say that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, coming from, you know, reading Murray Rothbard and Hans Hermann Hoppe, I have an interest in capitalism, but I think my interest in capitalism is kind of limited to like a meta space, you know, which is a big problem, because I think a lot of libertarians just think like that. You know, they just think about things like, this idea is the most logical, therefore we should do it. But I don't really think the world plays out like that. And, you know, I'm trying to learn about a lot of these things, but some of it is a bit over my head. I think that Anthony Michaels, you've had him on your show before, Robert?
Anthony Michaels, yeah.
Michaels, yeah. I think his ideas are probably the closest to the way I think, but I also have trouble understanding them. Like,
are you
like
talking
I
about
know,
his accent or the way he presents them?
No. Just the idea. I mean, I'm just, you know, I need to spend more time trying to wrap my head around something like social credit.
The thing is, I remember we had that candidate on, Scott Smith, and
yeah,
he had great
yeah,
ideas,
yeah, exactly.
But it's hard to market these economic
hard,
ideas to your average
They're very
person.
Complicated. They're very complicated. But, you know, we're moving towards full-on automation. You know, people that are doctors are not going to, you know, in 50 years, you're going to have robots doing these jobs. You know, almost every job can be replaced by automation. So we're going to be dealing with a very different world. I mean, a lot of these things are unpredictable. So I think we need to move into new forms of how we trade with one another. And I feel like systems like social credit are an improvement, but I think at the same time they're super complicated, and I might be a little too dumb to try to get too into them. I have to read more.
I would like to talk about Gore Vidal. He's an interesting person because he was a major icon of the left, and he was also pretty much very much well respected among the sort of liberal intellectual elite in New York. But at the same time, he had a lot of very dissident and subversive views that would be considered kind of a radical center or alt-left. He was sympathetic to the America First movement in World War II. He's made some comments about mass immigration. I think he was asked about people. He was talking to some liberal journalists saying that all these people who are opposing mass immigration into, like, Europe, they're racist. And then Gore Vidal was like, no, they're just acting in self-preservation. And he also advocated an alliance with the United States and Russia as a counterbalance to Asia. He's also had some interesting views about human sexuality and homoeroticism as well. So he's one of the most fascinating intellectual figures of the 20th century. Rabbit, you're a big fan of Gore Vidal, so I'll let you go ahead and talk about him.
Yeah, he's one of those people who, like many of his time, he was, you know, considered to be very, very anti-racist, but as I pointed out before on other shows, a lot of the figures from the 60s and these eras are now considered like white supremacists and whatnot, like retroactively. A lot of you can find articles about Gore Vidal that accuse him of, especially when he died, you know, like, don't mourn for this guy.
Oh.
He was a racist
oh,
white
yeah,
supremacist.
I see this article right now on Slate. It says, stop eulogizing Gore Vidal. This is when he died. And then the writer, his name was David Greenberg.
parentheses.
He said he was a racist and an elitist, forever mourning the decline of an era of an aristocratic privilege. And basically,
right.
Sorry, that was that.
Oh,
the
other yeah. thing. The other thing about him is that in this article by Greenberg, he says towards the end of his life, he discredited himself with the left because he embraced a lot of loony ultra-right-wing causes, including Ruby Ridge. He eventually also corresponded with Timothy McVeigh.
Yeah, and of course, in the late 90s, he gave that that famous talk, which was the folly of mass immigration, where he basically said that, you know, that he was for open borders a little bit, but because times have changed to the point where you know, millions of people can move at a time, essentially, that, you know, if millions of these Bengalis could move to Sweden and Norway, and the Norwegians said, you know, no thanks, we'd rather not take them, like, that, you know, they're perfectly within their right to do that because it's just an act of self-preservation. You know, so he was opposed to mass immigration. And mentioned before, that, you know, he's also considered to be a white supremacist because he wanted to the U.S. to ally with the Soviet Union against Japan and China and these rising Asian countries. And he was also against political correctness, and he was accused of being anti-Semitic because he pointed out that the you know, the Israeli and Jewish movement in the U.S. was a quote, a fifth column, acting on behalf of another nation's interests, Israel. But then at the same time, he also defended Roman Polanski because he thought that the press at that time was too anti-Semitic.
He offended everyone with the Roman Polanski thing. He's like, so what if the guy screwed the girl? But then he called him like some Jew something. So he offended both sides. He offended the Jews, but then he also offended the people who were horrified by Roman Polanski.
You don't really have a lot of those figures now that are just sort of universally offensive anymore. You know,
they just say whatever their actual opinion is, and they're not part of the team, really. And
yeah,
that's
why
they're defending all of these different groups. Yeah,
that's how I feel about myself. I don't really care about anyone liking me at all. I don't want to go off about myself, but I just think we all probably think like this, and that this is just my opinion, and I'm sure you can agree, and Robert can agree, and I find it to be, you know, pretty disturbing how bad this hegemony has gotten, that there aren't really dissident figures in the public at all anymore. I mean, can you guys think of anyone comparable to Igor Vidal who doesn't really fit into anything and sort of says how
well, no one major. I guess we kind of do, but we're just floating out there in outer space like Pepe's.
Yeah, but maybe people think Bill Maher does it, but, you know, he doesn't at all. But that's the closest thing you'll get.
Maybe, you know, we're still fairly young. So, I mean, so that's also somewhat of a luxury, I think, as if when you become older and are, you know, a super well-established figure and ultra-wealthy, then you can pretty much, kind of like Clint Eastwood is the only one that comes to mind, where he can just basically just say whatever the hell he wants on any given issue. But I wouldn't really call him a real intellectual. Like, he's not in Gore Vidal's league.
Gore Vidal interviewed Philip Roth, and he had this book, A Plot Against America, and it's like an alternative history science fiction novel where Charles Lindbergh becomes a fascist dictator of America. And I know Gore Vidal basically like pulled that book out as like a bullshit.
Yeah, I haven't read the interview. I'm more familiar with some of Gore Vidal's fictional stuff, like his screenplays and Visit to a Small Planet and Caligula, some of that sort of thing. That's one thing that I think sets me apart from a lot of the conservatives is the cultural stuff from the 50s and 60s that I'm really into is like a lot of the stuff that like the conservatives and radical traditionalists like, you know, they want to burn all that stuff down and go back to like pre-Enlightenment, you know?
Well, Gore Vidal was kind of part of the 60s counterculture, and he's
totally
written, he started out becoming controversial, but not today. Controversy comes from being politically correct, but from the kind of a conservative standpoint, he originally was controversial back in the 60s and even in the 70s for a lot of the stuff he wrote about sexual issues.
Yeah, well, he wrote a novel that initially was what got him involved in a lot of controversy, was that he wrote a novel that was like an openly gay novel, but it presented the homosexuals weren't stereotypical like gays, like they were just kind of like normal like muscular guys camping, you know, or whatnot. It was portrayed as being very. They weren't like the drag queens or anything like that. So I think that he got in a lot of
sounds very Omera-esque.
Yeah, it totally. I think. Go ahead.
I mean, a lot of, you know, because just thinking about homosexuality, you know, and like Yukio Mishima, and didn't Nietzsche kind of advocate for some stuff like that? And his idea of like in relationships, I don't know, it might be sort of outside of my knowledge base.
I'm sure a lot of the ancient Greek philosophers that all these traditionalists admire were engaging in some pretty extreme forms of homoeroticism.
Yeah, I mean, there is this, you know, belief in like man-to-man love as being the most masculine thing possible. And I'm sure me saying that will make every alt-right person listening to this think that this Jew is trying to subvert the movement and make all you gay, but which I'm not at all. I'm just saying, you know, reading Yukio Mishima and seeing that kind of line of thought. I mean, people like Omiera, that doesn't sound too off the wall to me. I think there was a idea of like the super brutally macho gay man. I mean, Jack Donovan is basically that for the modern era.
Wasn't there some concept in ancient Roman Greece where there was never like a homoerotic relationship where there were two equals? Usually involved one partner was dominant, or there was like a large age disparity between the two people.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Plato. Oh, do you know that, Rabbit? You're gonna say that?
I was gonna say that the stigma back then was not about homosexuality. It was just against whoever was the submissive partner. So it was like either if the the dominant male was was still held in high regard, it didn't matter who the submissive person was, if it was a man or a woman. It was the stigma was against the really the submissive partner or the those people were all stigmatized, regardless of like whether if it was male on male, or male on female. It was the dominant person was still they were considered to be fine. You know,
I know in ancient Greece they had the whole sort of a apprenticeship or mentor where like an older warrior would take in a younger warrior, and that would be a sort of like dominant homoerotic relationship.
Right. And when they, the one that's being mentored, if that person, you know, didn't grow up into being a masculine dominant, but continued to be like a submissive, then that person was considered to be very low on the hierarchy. So the stigma wasn't so much against, the type of sexuality, but the person's role was what was important in ancient Greece and Rome. There it was pretty heavy sexuality, especially in places like Pompeii and in those types of places, which is initially like a lot of why when I was a kid I lost interest in Catholicism and Christianity, was when I started studying like the Roman Empire and Greek mythology and that stuff, and I was just like, gee, you know, like this, like before Christianity, like Rome was so much cooler, you know. So I began to like start to resent Catholicism.
So one thing about Gore Vidal is that he was a cultural elitist, and I think cultural elitism is a very kind of important concept, because you have kind of elitism in our society is defined purely on economic terms, and there's really not really a cultural elitist are kind of, in a sense, almost kind of marginalized today. And
well,
he came from a kind of like old wealth kind of background.
You know what I think is kind of an interesting thing to bring up here is Gavin McInnes's role in the current political conversation. I mean, I think, you know, as embarrassing as it is, last year I got into a lot of these dissident ways of thinking through watching the Gavin McInnes show. And Gavin McInnes was like the guy who basically invented hipsterdom, who invented the kind of, you know, modern hipsterdom is kind of like the preservation of Western cultural elitism. And I think there's this whole idea of like, you know, you're a hipster, and people shunning this label and not wanting to embrace it. But the older I get and the more that kind of movement dissipates, the more I'm like, well, I think that actually was something that was really good.
Yeah, and like I remember we discussed this, but how the hipster movement has kind of like, you know, the scene has kind of degenerated from when I was like involved in the 90s and early 2000s. There was like this arty pretentiousness to it, where now it's like a very it's kind of like almost like cool to be white trash. You know, you see a lot of these hipster, like these mega bearded, like Sons of Anarchy, you know, kind of like tattooed and gauges and that kind of thing. Whereas before it was just, it was more, I would say cultural elitist. You know, you talk about like Italian films and things like that. And,
yeah.
Old music.
Yeah. Definitely. And now it's sort of like listening to, you know, these people listen to Beyonce.
We talked about like capitalism and how a lot of people are driven by like greed to achieve great things. And I think it's a human like desire to have a need for a status and to want status and to increase their status as a motivating factor for success. The problem of our society is that we have a kind of a caste system or class system based purely on how much money you have, and it doesn't matter how trashy you are. Like, you can be the trashiest person imaginable, and as long as you're rich or famous, you get a lot of respect and admiration. But at the same time, I don't think that egalitarianism works, because egalitarianism brings everyone down to the lowest common denominator. I think the key thing is to have a hierarchy or caste system based on our culture.
You need an aristocratic egalitarianism. You need sort of like people who are, you know, you need to admire the good life and see the people who live life in the most purest individualistic way possible and have a kind of egalitarianism that revolves around that, if you're going to have it at all.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that the so-called cultural elitism that exists now is really just based purely upon money and like media marketing. Cause it's, you know, you see these people like Beyonce or Kanye West or a lot of these pop figures, you know, they can't even articulate a sentence, you know, and I'm almost offended by when I hate when people like, conservatives complain about like these elites. Like, I don't even think that they're like, that's giving them too much credit. Like, these people who are in these positions now, they're like, they're not elites. Like, they're total idiots. You know, they're,
well,
a lot of these rappers can't even, you know, they can't even communicate like they're just like vocalizing.
Well, they're complete garbage. But the thing is, conservatives are not in a position to complain about these people, because they kind of created the issues. Conservatives strive for an America where people are judged more on, they said America's great because people have economic opportunities to become rich rather than a place to create a highbrow, create culture, and that people should be judged more on their money than on their culture. So I think conservatives are just as complacent. They're in no position to like criticize these people as much garbage as they are.
And I also think that, you know, signaling how virtuous you are is a way to hire yourself within the caste system as well.
There's a lot of wealthy people with status and power. They're not compassionate people. They're very cutthroat, almost like social Darwinist in a sense.
But then they they'll adopt a child from a third world country and say that they
are a
saint.
Yeah, it's just basically it's virtue signaling. It's a way to demonstrate their status.
And everyone falls for it.
We're getting towards the end of the show. Rabbit, is there anything else you'd like to add about Gorbita? We only kind of touched upon him briefly.
No, but I think that people should check out a lot of his old movies, the screenplays that he wrote. I find them to be very entertaining, and though a lot of them were written at a very, at a time when things in media weren't very, media was very sanitized in terms of movies and whatnot. It's if you watch those, some of his old films, like Visit to a Small Planet, you can find hidden gems in there that you're like, you can see parts of his personality coming out.
Well, we're out of time, so I would like to thank Alex and Rabbit for being on.
Thank you very much.
Thanks
guys.
Again.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.